Eddie Lockjaw Davis and Johnny Griffin with Walkin'. It's from their joint 1961 album, Blues Up and Down. Of course, Davis and Griffin are both on tenor sax, Lloyd Mayers on piano, Larry Gales on bass, and Ben Riley on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And today, we're going to have a kind of hodgepodge, in a sense, because I want to talk about, principally, I want to talk about your views about Donald Trump's first 100 days and how you got through them, but most importantly, what you learned about this political system, what you learned certainly about Donald Trump, but what you also learned about yourself. Do you have new political views, or is it the same, more intense? We'll get to that. But first, I want to bring your attention to two police killings stories. And one comes out of South Carolina. You may recall that contentious and explosive case involving Walter Scott, and the police officer who shot him, even as he was on the ground, posing no threat to the officer, and with the officer giving a very, very different accounting of what had happened, except that fortuitously we had a passerby, a citizen, who documented the event, the killing, on his phone camera. And so people were able to see the difference, but between what actually happened and what the officer, Michael Schlager, said happened. Well, today he's expected, the officer, Michael Schlager, is expected to plead guilty after all, but not before the feds, because he was first charged on a state criminal charge, and for some reason, we all know the reason, for some reason, the trial ended in a mistrial. The federal government then took the case and charged him under civil rights violations. And he was, Schlager was fighting this charge as well. And apparently the government, the feds, worked out a deal that was satisfactory. What is the deal? Well, according to the Los Angeles Times, it means that with this deal, Schlager has a better chance, a better chance at a lesser sentence. The federal government, says the Times, the federal government will advocate for Schlager's crime to be treated at a lower offense level. How about that? So we see here a multitude of questions that arise again in instances of police killings. This is a white police officer, and it's following that pattern. White police officer, African-American victim, under circumstances that, in a fair process, would have resulted in the conviction of the officer at the state level, which is, of course, naturally where it ought to start, the conviction of the officer on murder charges. The officer lied so many times about what happened, but this incredible document, this filmed document, contradicted just about everything he said. He said that the victim, Walter Scott, was trying to reach for his taser or perhaps even his gun. He was, of course, afraid for his life, and he shot him. And the way he shot him, we saw on the tape, the way he shot him was that he shot him while he was running away, clearly unarmed, and he shot him multiple times, and he is insisting, he was insisting that it was the victim, Walter Scott, who precipitated everything, and that he acted, and here's a key phrase, within departmental guidelines. Okay. Textbook case of what happens in police killings way too often all across the country. So they get a hung jury in the state trial. Usually this happens after they've done a bit of judge shopping, that the judge hearing the case would, be a bit more lenient, a little bit more lax in the strict application of the law. We also have to look at the role of the prosecutor in this case, because in most of these cases, you find evidence also, apart from police misconduct, you find evidence of prosecutorial misconduct, you find evidence of judicial misconduct, all working together as a symphony, a perverted symphony, to deliver the inevitable not guilty result. So Michael Schlager got through that first hurdle. Nothing stuck at the state level. But at the federal level, now the state level was murder, criminal. Because of intense community pressure, the state case went to the federal level, the old Justice Department and the federal level. This is now Jeff Sessions, who is absolutely dedicated to not convicting police officers in these kinds of cases. And in fact, he has said that the Justice Department, he doesn't want the Justice Department to handle these cases anymore. He'd rather, do real justice. And in a strange way, he has a point, and I'll tell you what. The state level is where, just rife with corruption and irregularities, all kinds of things happen. How many cases have I covered about what happens at the state level where the police unions have heavy, heavy sway, where the DAs, we saw that in Ferguson, the district attorney actually becoming a part of the apparatus of expunging the officer and literally building the case that Michael Brown was responsible for triggering everything that happened to him. So here we have the federal government now, because of intense pressure, the case at the state level did not stick. They take over the case, and now here's what is going on. It's a negotiation. It is all negotiation. And he is facing just one civil rights violation charge. This is no longer murder. This has nothing to do with murder at the federal level when he is supposed to be, quote, prosecuted, unquote. The charge now becomes violating Walter Scott's civil rights. In exchange, says the Los Angeles Times, in exchange, two other federal charges against him will be dropped, as will a state murder charge. Now, what is this? What is this? This, of course, means there's not going to be a trial at all at the federal level. The feds have already indicated a prejudicial position that is more concerned about the rights of the killer than the person he killed. And we see a repeat of this all the time. All the time. He is not going to face the proper charges. He's not going to be accountable as a police officer. And all this talk about police reform and criminal justice reform. Well, right now, as a matter of fact, Jeff Sessions is saying, you know, reform is not what he's about. He's not interested in reforming anything. Certainly not this area of reform, which was the most intensely concentrated on. So you see, we playing games, and a lot of these cases, when they start adding up to the monstrous numbers that we know of, where there's collusion to derail justice, collusion to automatically expunge blame from the errant officer who clearly is guilty. I mean, even after you have video showing what happened, it's like that famous line from Groucho Marx, do you believe me or your lying eyes? That's what they're saying to people. Your eyes are lying to you. Believe me instead. So this case is going to go that route. It's already done. The deal is made. And look what we are seeing and what we are witnessing. We have the government, Civil Rights Division, agreeing with, I mean, after the state has done its thing, and that still needs to be looked at, how this police officer escaped any kind of sanction at the state level for killing a person so brazenly, lying about it. The whole network that went into action there to protect him and to deliver him from the jaws of justice. And then they move to the next level of corruption and absolute disregard for people's rights, for justice, for what should happen here. They go to the federal level and they seal the deal at the federal level. So he's not even facing a murder charge. He is facing a charge of violating someone's civil rights. And that's as far as the federal prosecution is willing to go. And, you know, Slater would go on with his life. And we, the public, we, the people interested in justice and so forth, we are supposed to be content with this outcome. The other case is a case that happened really fairly recently. And that was a case involving, this was, I think, over on Saturday, this past Saturday, where a group of teens gathered at the suburb of Houston, Texas, at a party, a kind of house party that troubled the neighbors because it was too noisy. And what for whatever reason, complaints came into the police department, and it was about an unruly situation that bothered people in the neighborhood. As the police arrive, some of the kids, seeing that this was getting a little out of hand, tried to get away. And that included a young 15-year-old named Jordan Edwards. He and others, about four others, jumped into a car trying to get out of the way of police, and he was shot. A police officer with a rifle shoots at the departing car, in which Jordan Edwards is sitting in the front seat, the front passenger seat. Well, the police officer gave an entirely different account. He has not been identified. He enjoys his privacy. And he gave an entirely different account of what happened. And the system gave backup to that and said, yes, the police officer said that it wasn't that the car was running away from him. The car was driving away from him. In fact, he said the car was aggressively backing up to where he was. And of course, in fear for his life, he took out his rifle and shot at the car and obviously at the occupants of the vehicle. And sadly, very sadly, but very unintentionally, of course, this young man was shot in the back of his head and died. Well, the update to this was a statement yesterday. And the statement yesterday was that the police chief said he misspoke about the circumstances involving the police officer with his rifle shooting at the car. He misspoke, except that he had already established that the people in the car somehow were part of some unruly and unlawful conduct and behavior at this loud and rowdy party that required police to respond with rifles and guns and whatever it is. But that was the impression, that was the statement he made, that the police officer fired at the car as it aggressively backed up in the direction of where the officer was standing, and so the officer was forced to respond with the rifle. Okay. But the police chief yesterday said that he misspoke. And the reason he said he misspoke was because videotape was obtained that showed what happened. The car wasn't coming at him. They were trying to get away. They were trying to get out of a situation. So five guys jumped in the car, including, you know, people who were at this party, and presumably trying to get out of trouble, trying to get away before anything worse happens. The neighbors had called police. It was clearly a situation. You know, you have these things happening all the time, people thinking it's too much noise, it's too late for all this noise. Come and straighten things out and break up the party so we can go to sleep. A cop goes for his rifle. So he is viewing without knowing anything about who is in the car, why they're there, what relationship they have to the party, if any. He reaches for his rifle and the car and everybody in it become targets, target practice. He lets loose with his rifle. This young man is dead. And his school coach described him as a very, very promising young man who was, you know, going to be a football star and was training and so forth. Perhaps that's why he decided, when he saw things were getting a little out of hand and he saw that the cops had shown up, decided that he and his buddies better get out of there. The police chief says he misspoke. The beginning of the lie. And somebody had the wisdom to see to it that they could collect as much evidence as possible. They collected a video that shows exactly what happened. The car wasn't coming at the cop. That was a lie. The car was running. The car was driving away from the scene where the cop was. So we see the beginning of the process occurring there. And in the meantime, we're still being told that, you know, we should trust the police, trust what they say. This is how it unfolds all the time. And people are expected to be very calm and trusting of people who have no problem lying. No problem lying at all. These are just black kids. Walter Scott was just another black guy. Everybody knows what to do. Everybody knows what to do. And what to do is to protect these offenders, these killers on the force. No matter what, justice will not prevail. If they really, really stick to it, you might get something of the, like the first case I talked about today, where the police officer is persuaded to plead guilty, even though if he went to trial, a jury trial, which is what is in order here, you put 12 people in a box and they decide. And everybody knows what they would have decided because the evidence was so heavily weighted against the officers. But in that, even in that situation where the jury speaks, where the jury would have convicted, where there is an actual indictment, you have to understand this is like a big deal to get an indictment against a police officer for killing somebody. That in itself is unique because they quash this before it gets to that stage. But the entire law enforcement system has as its number one mandate the protection of its officers, including officers who do outrageous things like this. So we'll be checking on this case, and we'll come to understand yet again. I mean, I have no idea how black and brown communities in the United States that experienced this routinely haven't just exploded. Well, it's probably because they'll bring out the heavy artillery to really blow everybody away. But this is a murderous pattern. And when you hear about these, empty platitudes about from the Justice Department and the president and whatever it is, how concerned they are about police misconduct, they call this. Murder becomes misconduct. This is misconduct. And the police chief having the nerve to say that he misspoke. How the heck you could misspeak about whether a cop took a rifle, pointed it at a car driving away from him? He doesn't know who's in the car. It is not important to him who's in the car, whether they have committed any crime. But he knows that they're black. And you can take your rifle and you shoot. You got it like that. And then you can go home to your home, to your family. And you can go back to work and be embraced. The police chief has already indicated a prejudice. Prejudice, naturally, is in favor of a member of the police force doing outrageous stuff that couldn't possibly be part of any departmental regulation, that what he did was okay and lawful. He had no idea who was in the car. He had no idea if even a crime had been committed. A crime was not committed. But because in his racist head, anybody fleeing a scene could only be, guilty, number one. And it was clear that he had ideas about who the occupants of the vehicle likely would be. So I'll pause here for a minute, come back to you, and we'll talk about this extraordinary historical period that we're in right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And, well, a lot of you know, a lot of noise was made about President Trump's first 100 days. I don't get it, where, you know, people install these kinds of markers and these kinds of rituals, the first 100 days. I don't know, you know, whatever that's supposed to signify. But it is a marker that has been used principally by the media as some kind of marker as to the performance of a new president or a new executive, a chief executive. How have you done in your first 100 days? Well, the jury has come in, mixed reviews. The people who voted for Donald Trump loved him and still do love him. And the people who didn't vote for Donald Trump still don't like him. And life goes on. But still, we can't negate or ignore the historicity of this president and the period that he has ushered in simply by being in office, being elected to office. We have talked about Donald Trump quite a lot, mostly from the point of view of the highly irregular situation that he poses as a person who never held public office, a person who is completely inexperienced in this arena and certainly in this position. And we got very early on, this is even during the campaigning process, we got a very interesting view of Donald Trump, the man, what he thinks, and even if he thinks, he's not a thinker, he is a doer, he shoots from the hip and the lip, but not given to very thoughtful action. And in many ways has caused great concern to people who worry about the mental stability of a person occupying the highest office in the land. His actions suggest a less than thoughtful process. His actions suggest that he primarily pleases himself first. What he wants to do, he's running the country essentially like a business. One of his businesses is just another one of his businesses. So that's how he's running the country. And we, the people, have to go along with it. His latest tweet yesterday was that he wants to shut down the government when its term ends, the fiscal term ends at the end of September. He wants to shut things down, and he will then redo everything according to his vision and his likeness. And therefore, he wouldn't have to constantly struggle with resistance to any of the things he wants to do, whether in Congress or outside of it. So he is, you know, he floats these ideas. He's become accustomed to the idea of jerking our chains, getting us all paranoid and, just totally off center because we are so worried about what this man would do next. We have news today from North Korea that he should be very, very careful because they're prepared for nuclear war. We have news from South Korea that a warning to Trump, do not meddle in our affairs. We know the history, the recent history that involved bombing in Syria and Afghanistan, putting troops on the ground, conducting these war exercises alone and in conjunction with so-called allies, preparing for war. And yet, a great effort is being made to convince us that everything is okay. Again, do you believe us or your lying eyes and ears? Everything is all right. And if it should come to war, don't worry, we could handle it. We can handle it. We can win, as if there's any winning in this kind of war. There's no winning. There's just death and devastation. And as you look at the leadership of other countries, you can easily tell that our chief executive has some very strange ideas about how one conducts, how a head of state conducts him or herself in the world community of nations. We're not looking good at all. And it is not to be a casual consideration that no matter what happens, we will win. That's just stupid analysis that we're getting. Don't worry. You know, nobody wants war, but if we have to go to war, we will win. So I was wondering, what is your take? What is your take on the president's first 100 days? What has it done to you? I mean, forget about him personally, but what has it done to you? What has it caused you to do that represents a change in your life? And what are you thinking now that you didn't think before? Or what are you contemplating now, having come through, as we all have, having come through a rather interesting 100 days? Let's talk to Jose from Rosedale.
Greetings, my professor. Hello. Hope all is well with you.
How are you?
Very, very, very distraught and frustrated, but the old-timer is hanging in there.
Oh, good.
I would like to pass on the Donald Trump situation. And as an elder, if it's all right with you, you
sure.
know, it takes us a little while to get our thoughts together. And so if you just bear with me a little, right?
Sure.
No,
so
I
you're
want
talking
you to
about
know.
The police situation?
Yes, yes.
Okay,
I want you to know that I am not the brightest of your student. But I figured it out a long, long time ago. My seven, going on eight decades on this planet, most of it spent in my adopted homeland here. I have figured it out a long time ago. And you see, every step of the way, we as a people, we have each era we have been through, it's always been tumultuous and trying. And it is something that we are never out. We are never out of trials and tribulation. Our lives seem to be a constant cycle of pain. And everyone seems to look at us as an impotent race of people that is powerless to do anything in defense of themselves. And so everybody feels that they can dump on us and do all manner of evil to us. And we can intellectualize our condition all we want to. We can talk about the law and what it relates to us and so forth, but we don't create the laws. The deals that was made on the backs of our people constantly for hundreds of years, we seem to have no control over that. So I want to just read something here real quick to remind our people that it's not just today we have been going through these trials and tribulations. Ever since we have been interacting with the oppressors, we have been suffering tremendously from these type of inequity and injustice, and we can't seem to do anything about it. So I want to remind us of something that this brother did many decades ago. His name is Claude McKay, right? Claude McKay wrote this poem in those days when we were again going through all kind of trials and tribulations. He said, and I quote, "If we must die, let it not be like hogs hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our cursed lot." He said, if we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave. And for the 1,000 blows, deal one death blow. What though before us lies, the open grave? Like men, we face the murderers cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back, unquote. And Mr. Garvey said, if you are strong, he was referring to us as African people. He said, if you are strong, you have justice on your side. He said, if you are weak, you are at the mercy of the dispenser of justice. He said, there is no justice but strength. There is no justice but power. He said, if you have sense and you want justice, get power. Get it quick. Get it anyhow. Unquote. And Brother Marcus, by Malcolm would say, by any means necessary. My professor, I saw recently where there was a fire, right, in a house someplace in New York, I believe it was. And these white firemen went into that burning house, risking their lives like they should. And the only occupant of the house was a dog. And when they pulled that dog out of there, the dog was dead. And that fireman, that white fireman, got down on his stomach. And he spread that dog apart and gave him CPR, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and revived that dog and brought that dog back to life. And he was a hero. And here's it. I am looking at us as human beings. And these same white folks are treating our people less than a dog. And we can't get it as a race of people that we can never appeal to the sensibilities of the oppressors. It will never happen. We can talk to ourselves and talk among ourselves if we want to. We understand the pressure that we're under, or we understand the plans that the oppressors have for us. We can't appeal to them. So we have to find a way to fight this system the way it is and to get justice for ourselves. How it's going to be done, I have some answers, but it might be too radical. But we have to come together, people, because there is a plan. There is a plan of action. Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder can see it as plain as ABC, the plan that they have for us, from the gentrification to what they are doing on the African continent, to Haiti, to the Caribbean. There is a plan for us as a people. But too many of us, our eyes are open, but we are still blind.
Within the capacity of people, the ordinary capacities of people, every day, what do you think is doable about the situation?
Okay, my professor, I was talking on a radio program some time ago. The mayor was on the program. And I challenged the mayor as to who really runs the police department in the city. I asked him if he was the one who ran the police department, or it was the police commissioner, or the Lynch's fellow here who's the head of the police union, or the governor. Who runs the police department? Because the promises that he made to our community that he was going to change and implement. I told him, you got in office, and these policemen had you back down. They disrespected you in the worst way. And you could not respond to them. You could not punish anyone. So when he was talking about cameras, body cams and so forth, I said, Mr. Mayor, if anybody should wear body cams, body camera, it should be us. We, the civilians, the victims, we are the ones that should have a body cam on. And that body cam should be linked directly to an independent unit where, even if we can't convict the police with these evidence from our body cams, we should be able to get it out in the world. The whole world should be able to see these atrocities. And maybe, just maybe, it might shame them into doing something. But these body cams that the police have, they can manipulate it and do whatever they want with it. And again,
one of the things I say all the time.
Yes, my professor.
The police commissioner, yeah, he runs the police department administratively. The mayor runs the town administratively. And you have other officials who have some kind of a supervisory or administrative responsibility with regard to the police department. But the City Council of New York has authority over all of them. All of them.
Who controls them?
Well, here's the thing. The City Council, for the first time, really, in this period that we're talking about, has the largest number of people from Black and Latino communities.
What does that mean?
But listen to what I'm saying. So they have ultimate responsibility for the functioning of the police department, the functioning of the mayor. They have the authority, the legal authority, to call the mayor on the carpet. They have the legal authority to stop funds from going to any agency that is so foul until there's an investigation. They have all of that authority for the first time. They got all that authority. It's not the mayor. They're the boss of the mayor. They're the people who are responsible for the budgets of every single department. And what
do
they
do? Who are their bosses?
What do they do? So that is part of the problem. People are being murdered, you know, like crazy. Not just in New York City, but in every city. But it is the police department, the police unions, the prosecutors, they all have their instructions. They know automatically what to do to get the result that is desired. But nobody is putting fire under the city council.
And
they more than any group out there, more than any other officials, it is the city council members who have great power to change things. If they're not going to do it, the people have to get them out.
Can I say
something? Because you can't leave it to the mayor to fix the department. He's not going to do that. You can't leave it to the police commissioner to fix the department. They'll say they'll do it, but they won't do it. But you have a police, you have a city council that can put the heat under all of them, and demand answers, not just for the police department, the corrections department, all law enforcement components of the city of New York. It's the city council that funds the department. It's the city council that actually constructs the city budget. Now, why is it that nobody, at a time when you think you should be able to press some buttons down there at City Hall and get something done, why is it that these folks are getting a free pass? Why are they getting a free pass?
Okay. Now,
you have to be quick because we're running out of time.
Good, but if you remember correctly, some time ago, we had a discussion on your program, and you talked about us forget the national politics, but go with the local politics. And I said, a lady called in, and she said the same thing. And I called up, and I said to you, we can vote for the local politician or upper politician, whatever we want to. Every single one of them is corrupted and they have a boss. We can vote for the local folks all we want to, but they are just as corrupt as the national politician because they have their bosses. The New York City Council members, many of them, they are in the pockets of the real estate developers and all these big shots who pump money into their campaign. They are not responsive to us. We the people. And we are not courageous enough.
The thing is, everything that you're saying has been well documented, and it's true. We cannot deny it. However, we haven't tried it. Seen no evidence that as a city of people outraged about anything, that they have gone down to the city council and in a systematic way have implemented a resistance to what is going on. I haven't seen it. They expect that people will just do the right thing, and they take no responsibility beyond voting for this person or that, and expect things to be done. They're not going to do it that way. This is part of what I say about what is the political response, what is the political action that the people are going to take.
You see, again, we keep trying to fight the oppressors using the same methods that they are. We're not using the same methods they use in fighting us. They use all kind of devious, underhanded, all kind of evil ways to fight us.
All of that said, Jose, all of that is a given. They've done all of that. But I still maintain there has been no concerted, organized effort to go down to City Hall and send an entirely different signal and to bring directly into account all the people who should be solving these problems but are not. We have taken a hands-off position. And so we get what we get. We don't get action because we don't demand any. And when we demand, it's a verbal thing. You know, we get up, we make noise, and then we go home. We have not seen, and I'm saying again, in the first time in New York City history, you have a predominantly non-white city council. And you still have evidence that folks are not taking care of business. So that is the issue that needs to be confronted. We've come to the end of the program. Thank you so much for calling and always raising our consciousness. I really, really appreciate that, Jose. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. We'll talk about Donald Trump another day, apparently, but that's okay. The idea is that this is what this program and this station are about, to engage people into discussing things that are mattering to them every single day. And therefore, in exchanging our views, we learn a lot more and we are able to make sense of our daily lives, how we ought to operate within it. Thank you so much. We'll see each other tomorrow. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.